This episode is brought to you by the American Homebrewers Association, organizers of the 23rd annual Learn to Homebrew Day, coming up on Saturday, November 6th. Learn to Homebrew Day is an opportunity to celebrate and spread the joy of the most rewarding and delicious hobby of all time. To encourage new and longtime homebrewers to join the fun, the AHA invites you to take $5 off a print or digital membership with the code LEARN2BREW21. That's Learn, the number 2, Brew, 21. Visit homebrewersassociation.org/LTHD to learn more and get involved. That's homebrewersassociation.org/LTHD. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, October 14th, 2021. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Peter Simons, author of Guile Brews, walks us through the techniques of making two worts out of one mash and using brewing software to blend them to make delicious beers. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. If you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs and our brewer's logbooks. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing, and find our show page on Facebook as well. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And thanks to our buddy who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. Boy, this month is speeding by. Still warm around here, but some of the leaves on the trees are changing. It's my favorite time of year. And you might, I don't know, depending on how sensitive this microphone is, you might be able to hear it raining in the background, which is something we needed for a long time. Now from weather, we move into, let's take a quick look into the mailbag. Last year, about this time, Dan from Tasmania, Australia, wrote about his ambitions to make ciders. Well, Dan wrote me a few days ago with an update. He says, we ended up finding three enormous apple trees in the nearest town to us, owned by a lady in her 80s. Her son, who makes cider, and could not use them all, so we got to take everything else in exchange for cleaning up her yard to keep the possums away from the rotting windfalls. Dan says she knew that one of the trees was a Cox's orange pippin she purchased from the local market as a bare-rooted tree, obviously some time ago. Dan says, needless to say, we had a lot of apples, probably about 20 wheat sacks full. I enlisted my three child laborers to chop and juice them as we don't have a press. Original gravity was 1050 and final gravity was 1001, so it fermented pretty dry. Dan says, fermented with the US05 and nothing else. Then force carbonated after 6 weeks in primary and 1 week cold crash, turned out a lovely clear straw color. Fresh apple juice nose with a slight tartness right up front and a bit of sweetness on the mid-palate and then a dry apple finish. Mmm, that sounds really good. Only the third cider we've made, I must say this is excellent, Dan says. Hopefully we can source the same apples next year. Well, how fun is that? Getting the family involved and making some delicious cider. Dan sent me a picture of his cider and it's beautiful. And, you know, it's getting to be spring in Australia down there, and Dan says he's going to try to grow some chilies and ferment them like I've been doing in the Patreon bonus videos. Well, up in this half of the world, as I said, it's fall, and it's time to start thinking about making some ciders. And, you know, the seasonal strain from Imperial Organic Yeast, the current one, has got you covered. A40 GF Bubbles is a traditional cider strain. Bubbles is a beautiful strain for fruit juice fermentations. The clean profile of the yeast, especially when used at the lower end of the temperature range, allows the nuances of the fruit to be prominent in the finished bubbly beverage. The strain is produced on 100% gluten-free media. Imperial Yeast doesn't recommend the strain for use in wort-based fermentations, but, you know, if you're industrious like Dan and you get a bunch of apples and put your kids to work and juicing them, or even pears this fall up here in the Northern Hemisphere, think of Imperial A40 GF Bubbles. You know we love Imperial with those 200 billion cells in each easy-to-open package. My stir plate is dusty because I don't make starters anymore for moderate-gravity 5-gallon batches. and my airlock is usually bubbling before bedtime. Ask your local homebrew store about Imperial Organic Yeast and check them out at imperialyeast.com. Well, a few days ago, I got a note from Peter Simons with a link to a YouTube video that he had produced showing how to design Partigiale recipes using brewing software. It's kind of tricky, you know, because you're dividing up the fermentables from a single mash, and then the way Peter does it, he blends those two worts proportionally to create custom brews to meet your specifications. Well, I had a lot of questions about the specifics of how Peter's brew day actually works. Peter Simons, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
G'day, James. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, not too bad, considering. Considering being the operative word.
Yes, exactly. We were commiserating before we turned on the recorder that, you know, talking about lockdown life and, you know, how our different cultures are handling the pandemic on opposite ends of the world here. But video conferencing is in now, so we're all cool.
Yes, yes. But I guess New South Wales has a long history of practicing lockdowns and curfews from previous times as a penal colony, and the present government have reinstituted a few of those old school restrictions.
Well, I'm not going to comment on our situation up here. So it's
It would be nice that we were BC before COVID, when things were somewhat saner.
Amen. Amen. Well, we're talking about Guile Brew. The name of your most recent book is called Guile Brews, and we're talking about Partigiale brewing. You're spelling guile, G-U-I-L-E, on the book, but normally when we talk about Partigiale, it's G-Y-L-E. Is there a difference, or should we care?
Well, you should care a little bit, because guile, G-U-I-L-E, was the way it used to be spelt. we're around 1800, turn of that century. Spelling was different then. It was much more optional. So guile, being a G-U-I-L-E, I thought that was a sneaky sort of double entendre, shall we say, because guile today means crafty.
Mm.
And to be able to do crafty brews, you need to do guiles, and guile being a batch of beer from one mash. So all the brewing books that I've seen have had the word guile liberally sprinkled in. I think they bought books by the dozen. So whatever they did in subsequent years, they still always had guile written down, and perhaps that's how it's perpetuated.
And if you drink enough of beer, you can become beguiling for just a little while.
Beguiling. Very good.
That's
very
the title good. Of the next one there. No charge.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Excellent.
But these are historic UK recipes, right? Or in that region of the world. These are beers that you have done quite a bit of research, and we've talked about the book on a previous episode in what seems like a short time ago, but I know it's been a long time ago. But these are beers that you have revisited and resurrected, so to speak, and have breathed new life in. And some of these techniques also, you're not only bringing up to modern brewing techniques, but you're using computers to execute them as well.
It's a difficult concept. I think people are genuinely quite intimidated by the whole idea of a Partigiale process. In In essence, it is a multiple beer approach. And to be able to do that, you do need some tools to be able to work through your recipes, work out your overall gravities from all the beer you're going to produce. And then you need some technology to assist that. And I use Brewfather. I used to use Promash. The concepts are generally the same, but you have to learn the program to be able to do that. And then you've got to deal with, so you get a theoretical expectation of what you're trying to do. One of the benefits of having researched so much is I've got actual examples of 20th century Partygeiling. And from those examples, you can scale them and convert them to a homebrew size batch. So at least you've got an outline as to what you expect to get. What you actually get could be a bit different, and that's very much system related.
Mm-hmm.
But you can compensate for that. But you do need, I think, a bit of a plan to begin with to be able to estimate what you're trying to do. So I've based it very much on the actual historical record, but that provides a platform for other experimentation and doing different things. The Partygeiling is a relatively recent, in historical terms, relatively recent thing. Probably began in late Victorian times. Once you had sparging technology available, it meant that you could industrialize the way you brewed. Now Fuller's is very much the exemplar of Partygeil brewing, because they still do it today.
Mm.
What happened prior to that, and a lot of people focus on that in the written texts that I've seen, is that they basically did no sparging because they didn't have the sparging technology. So what you would do, you would mash once, run that off. That was your first beer. Well, after you boiled it, etc. Then you would flood the grain and the grist again and run the next one off and the next one off. So you ended up with perhaps three different beers of different strengths. Now, they could have blended those together, but mostly the historical texts that I've seen seem to have treated them as separate beers. Once you got to the situation that you could sparge, it then meant that you could run off, say, from 2 mash tons to a copper. Now, I suppose I ought to explain. In UK terminology, a copper is, and used to be, actually made out of copper, is the boil kettle. So copper equals kettle, kettle equals copper. So when I talk about coppers, think kettles boiling, etc. So what you would have is first mash, you'd mash that one, run that off to your first copper, you boil that first copper, then you sparge the mash again, and once your first copper is finished boiling, you'd then run the wort from into the second copper, which is obviously going to be a much lower gravity, and you boil that one. And then the art then comes into how you blend those two wort streams to make different beers.
And that's the twist that this book to me threw into my process, because I've done what I called Partygeil brewing, a couple, three times in the past. And what we've done is just collected the first wort, boiled it and used that as one beer, and then collected the second wort and boiled that, added hops and made that a second beer. And never the twain should meet. We didn't blend. And so that we kind of missed an important aspect of the whole thing. And so, you know, I was largely unsatisfied, especially with the quality of the second beer. But if I had known that you were supposed to, you know, blend in some of the first wort into the second and vice versa, then I think that I would have been a lot more happy, you know, with the balance of those two brews.
Yes, the textbooks of the time and the practice, as I can see from the brewing logs, they would always put some of the stronger wort into, let's say we had a strong bitter, an ESB or something like that, and a ordinary bitter, say a Chiswick bitter or something like that, then the Chiswick bitter would always get a fairly decent proportion of the first wort, because the book I read, it said you run the probability of thinness. Now, was that the sort of thing you were having a problem with? Because you've not necessarily got all the dextrins and other components from the stronger wort coming through in the final beer.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I compensated, I think on the last batch, I compensated by adding some dry malt extract. But still, and then some specialty grains to change it into a dark beer from the light beer, which was the first runnings. But still, you know, it wasn't exactly what I had anticipated. And so, you know, since reading your book, I said, well, Steve and I need to get together and do another Party Guile session. And then, you know, this global pandemic happened. So that's what I'm blaming, you know, our lack of progress, you know, in that situation. But talk about your setup. We have Brew in a Bag, and we'll get into that a little bit later on. But talk about your system that you have at home that you use to brew these beers.
Okay. Well, I have a three-vessel system. Let's say they're 60 liters each, approximately. I don't know what that is in gallons. Don't even know what that is in U.S. gallons. So they're a decent size. What I have is a hot liquor tank, because you need that for the sparging. I have a mash tun, which I recirculate using a Herms. And then I've got a copper. And it actually is a copper, because it's a converted washing copper. But it's made out of stainless, just to confuse everybody. So the sequence is fairly straightforward. You mash in, and you've calculated the gravity points that you want from all of the beers you're going to produce. And then you can choose how strong that first wort is by the volume that you choose to run off. Now, I'm talking a three-vessel system, not a brew in a bag at the moment.
Right.
The more you run off, the less gravity you're leaving in the grain, if you like. So you'll have a stronger first wort. So you boil the first wort. Now, you do need to consider the hop rate of copper one and copper two. You're going to have a strong wort. Perhaps when I did a Murphy's stout, the first runnings I got from that were in the order of 1074. And you need to have a hopping rate that suits that. So you tend to have to put two-thirds of your total hopping into the first boil, and perhaps a third in the second, because the second one came in at around 1025. So obviously you get much better utilization in the weaker wort.
Mm-hmm.
And then you blend.
Now my question here is kind of a one of technique. So you've boiled your first wort in your copper, in your kettle. Two questions. First off, do you then add the sparging water or the second water to the mash tun at that point and let it be sitting during the boil?
Right. So sequence-wise, yeah, well, the answer to that is yes. So sequence-wise, if you have, say it takes you about 60 minutes to heat up your strike water. Then you do your first mash. Let's say that takes overall about 90 minutes by the time you've put that into the copper. Do a nominal 60 to 90 minutes boil. Once you've got the boil underway, then your sparge liquor should have come up to temperature, and then while it's boiling away merrily, you can then run your sparge water in on top of the grains again, give it a good stir, recirculate, and let it sit there for another 60 minutes. So the remash, the sparge mash, if you like, is happening in parallel with the boiling of copper one.
Okay.
And once copper one is finished, and what I did with the Murphy's one, I went no chill. So I put it straight in a cube. So that cube was my intermediate vessel for blending. That freed up the copper. So I ran the wicker wort into the second copper, and then chilled that down. So I had an intermediate vessel from copper one. I had the copper two was just sitting there. And then I knew both gravities of those, and I knew what the volumes I had at the end of the boil, and then I could work out my blending.
And so I'm assuming that your wort from the both worts were still hot. So I'm assuming that the fermenters, did you wait until the next day until the wort cooled down, or do you rack and blend into fermenters that are heat tolerant at that time?
I let it sit overnight because my fermenter at the time were plastic.
Mm.
So yeah, that's a good point. So by letting it come down to temperature overnight, no chill's a fairly recognized technique. Then it was really a question of you had the volume, you knew what your temperature was, so that you could compensate for any shrinkages and all the rest of it. I had my theoretical calculation, which didn't quite match what I ended up with, which is perfectly normal. And then I blended and I added in a bit of additional liquor just to hit the correct gravities that I wanted. So yeah, that's how I've done about three full-on party girls over the last couple of years, and that's about that method works. But I did three different beers. If I was going to do the same beers each time, which I know is an anathema to homebrewers, I think I would have it dialed in. But I didn't. I went straight for something else.
Yeah, we tend not to have good attention spans when it comes to brewing the same thing over and over again.
Well, there's always room for improvement, isn't there?
Oh, yeah.
And your ingredients change, and I've changed my system a few times. But that, I think, would be a fairly decent way of going about it. Now, what you actually choose, you could do perhaps a different technique if you had stainless steel fermenters, in which case you could probably just run the wort straight in there and blend from that. That might be a bit more elegant than using no-chill cubes.
You know who can help you put together an excellent system to brew your Party Guile beers and every other beer you want to make? Our friends and sponsors, Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. I've got a single vessel brew in a bag Warthog electric system, and Steve does as well. His is smaller than mine. But you can go beyond that and save money at the same time. Do me a favor. Go to basicbrewing.com and click on the ad on the right-hand side of the page that says High Gravity Basic Brewing Code Deals. And that will take you to a special page on highgravitybrew.com that has a long list of Warthog systems that you can save $75 on by using the code EBC75BB. There's the terrific build-your-own brewing system page, the Warthog two-vessel systems from 10 gallons to one barrel, Warthog three-vessel systems available in both Herm's and Rim's configurations, of course single-vessel systems like mine and Steve's, and standalone Warthog controllers if you already have the other components to set you up your electric gear. HighGravityBrew.com can help you take the pain out of propane by going electric, and the code EBC75BB can save you $75 off your new Warthog system. Check out all the terrific gear and ingredients and kits at family-owned and operated HighGravityBrew.com. That's HighGravityBrew.com. Now, Steve and I have brew-in-a-bag systems, electric systems, and I looked back and watched a little bit of the video, the latest video that we did, latest Party Guile video that we did, and we mashed in my system, ran off the first wort into his kettle, and then he started the boil of his brew, and then I used my kettle as the second mash tun, and, you know, fiddled with the mash in that way. So using brew in a bag, we were trying to figure out, you and I, how you could do Party Guile using your blending technique, using just a single vessel system like brew in a bag. And I don't know that we figured that out, but you found instructions from, was it 1811? For a single vessel system in doing Party Guiles?
Yes, although they wouldn't have called it Party Guile in those days. It would definitely be G-U-I-L-E. They patented a what looks like your grain father, your single vessel brew in a bag system. Their technology was coal rather than electricity, mind. But the fundamental ideas of having perforated plates, being able to mash in the one vessel, it was a really interesting find. I found the 1821, it's like the user manual, was a bit more elegant. The 1811 version implied that you weren't mashing at all, but I think you were, because the grain was sitting in hot water for periods of time. But perhaps they meant by mashing the process of stirring, etc. So this particular system, the patented portable brewing machine, what they were able to do was they use, like I was talking about, the no chill cubes. They used wooden trays of suitable capacity as their intermediate storage. So their process, they did a first mash, they ran off to the cooler. Now, I guess you could use an igloo type, use a brand name, but, you know, an insulated vessel for that. So when they put their first wort into that, they covered it with hops, and then they kept on mashing in the single vessel, and they ran that one off to a second cooler. They put the first wort back into the single vessel, boiled it, put it back in the cooling tray to cool. Then they put the second wort back in on top of the reused hops, which were trapped with the perforated screens that they seemed to have, did the boil for that one, put it in the other cooling tray. So now you've got two cooling trays full of finished beer. But wait, there's more. They cleaned the first vessel and put the cooled first wort back into there and pitched the yeast in it. So not only was it a the mashing and boiling vessel, it was the fermentation vessel as well.
Wow.
They weren't that. So that's the strong wort in there. The second wort was just put straight into a barrel, pitched with yeast, and allowed to ferment. So perhaps taking some cues from 1821, if you used an insulated cooler or two of them to store your first wort and second wort, I'm not sure I'd advocate fermenting in your kettle or copper, but you could see a potential way of doing that using a single vessel system. What I'm not sure about is how your efficiencies might work with that system, with the brew in a bag. I would guess that the same rule would apply if you would not want to sparge.
Mm.
You'd want to make sure that you left residual gravity in the grain in the bag.
Right.
I guess. But it definitely needs somebody with some, you know, video capacity to prove or disprove whether that might actually work or not.
Now, the igloo people, I think they got nervous when they heard people were using their products as mash coolers. So they might be even more nervous to hear people, you know, pouring boiling wort. Well, no, it wouldn't be boiling at that point, would it? It would be mash temperature.
That's right.
It would still be mash temperature. I would get nervous, and of course you've got the no-chill containers, the cubes, or the jerry cans, as they're also called, and I guess theoretically you could move your wort around with those, although, you know, please be careful dealing with large amounts of of hot liquid as you're pouring things from back and forth.
They might actually be a better using a food safe cube,
mm-hmm,
with a pouring handle would probably be safer than at mash temperatures. You're quite right, we're not talking boil temperatures, and it will have cooled a bit in the cube. So yeah, a cube I think would be a way of having that intermediate vessel. But I reciprocate with the be careful because it's hot liquids and mm-hmm, all the rest of it.
So how do you've got a detailed video. If you go to YouTube and search for Triton Books, TRITUN Books on YouTube, that's your publishing firm. You've got a detailed 30-minute video on how people can develop recipes in Brewfather, and I'm assuming that the same principles can be transported from one platform to another. So how do you we can't get into all the details on here, and it would be confusing if you did, but how, give us an overview of how you take one of these recipes and translate it into brewing software in a way that works for homebrewers.
Well, it comes down to the essence of doing a recreation recipe. You've got a whole series of archaic measurements, Fahrenheit and things like that. couldn't resist. Pounds per barrel. So there's a degree of interpretation and experience required to work out from an original brewing record what they were trying to achieve. Take that initially, and the great thing about where they were doing party gars, you knew what gravity they were getting out of the copper. So copper one and copper two, you knew what the outturn volume and the gravity was. You knew what the grist was. You sometimes were given the details of the hopping rate. The hopping rate tended to be two-thirds in copper one and one-third in copper two. And if you're really lucky, they would actually mention the times of additions.
Mm.
So all those bits and pieces are good information. The particular record I used for the YouTube video came from John Groves of Weymouth, and they identified which sugars they put into copper one and copper two. And that's invert sugar and malt extract and other things. So it gave you a very complete view of what parameters you had to deal with. So to scale that, you knew what the gravities were out of the coppers. You turn that into a number of gravity points required for, let's say, a nominal 20-liter output, so five US gallons-ish of each of the two wort streams. Convert using percentages the grists. Convert the hopping rate, looking at the pounds per barrel, discounting for the age of the hops and other factors, turn that into grams per liter, pop that into the recipe, or even ounces per gallon if you must. That gave you an overall master recipe. That's all the wort that you needed to produce the two wort streams. So in effect, what you get from the old brewing book is, here's wort stream one, that's the high gravity one. Here's wort stream two, that's the lower gravity one. So you've got two beers to work through, two wort streams. You then work through the software to produce the required outputs of copper one and copper two. You then put them into the blending calculator, which I've got an online spreadsheet for. That then gives you your blending options, making sure that you always put some of the stronger wort in the weaker wort, which is what they did historically and I think is good practice. Add a bit of water or liquor if you must to get the required gravities. And there's your framework for being able to run your brew day with a reasonable expectation that you'll hit your numbers. One thing that I ought to mention, and it's quite crucial, is that you really do need to know the performance of your system. So by performance of the system, I mean in particular your boil-off rate and evaporation, that you've gauged everything, that you know what you're measuring is actually correct, which in some cases means you should measure volumes very accurately if you're using dip gauges or whatever. Obviously, your temperature measurements need to be fairly accurate as well. Those sort of things that affect your mash efficiency will obviously flow through into your outcomes if you're not careful.
Mm-hmm.
So you do need to adjust for your own system. And there's the basic platform for doing it. The magic is all in the blending. How you choose to do, I've gone with a very historical approach as something that's relatively simple. You can then overlay on that. You could make a much stronger first wort. So you could be at barley wine strength and then have a bitter, or you could do a triple X imperial stout and a porter. So you've got lots of possibilities. I didn't find anything to suggest that they were actually doing this capping the mash for a different second running beer. What they did seem to use a lot of were brewing sugars as a wort extender. And that gives you a lot of flexibility as well. But really, once you've cracked it, you should be able to produce from perhaps only an additional, perhaps couple of hours of effort, if that, by doing the parallel processing. You should be able to produce two beers almost at the same effort, a bit more, but close. Two very different beers. And then you've got all the options of fermentation. Different yeasts, different dry hopping regimes, et cetera, et cetera. So lots of room to play.
And as you said, you got to know your system, and you'll probably know your system a lot better after you attempt one of these, because then you're going to have some actual numbers to compare. But would you, when you're working the process, do you, because of the character of the beers, do you prioritize gravity over volume, or are those kinds of decisions, you know, do you have to make those as you're working the brew day?
Well, if you're working on a intermediate vessel approach, you're probably constrained by, let's say, the size of the cube. I mean, if it's 20 liters or whatever size that is. So you might have constraints. It is better to mash a few points higher, which is what I did in the ones that I experimented on. I made sure that I had more gravity than I thought I would need at the beginning. So I had more grain. In case I lost, I had more losses from unknowns later on. And that seemed to work. So if you get to the maximum capacity that you can of your mash tun, that's probably a good thing. That'll give you more buffer and more wriggle room. You'll know what your initial gravity into copper one is. And if that's on a bit of the low side, then perhaps you have to add a bit more brewing sugar into that one to or more extract or something, just to lift that up. If you're going to make two quite different gravity beers, you do need to make sure that the differential between copper one and copper two is probably 20 or 30 points.
Mm.
Because if you get them too close together, you're really just fiddling at the edges.
I guess my thinking was, if, say, you know, using my experience, if the gravity of the second wort was too low, you could sacrifice, in addition to adding sugars, you could sacrifice some of the volume by boiling a bit longer, you know, and driving up your gravity points that way. Now that would mean that you would have to re-enter your figures into the blending calculator, because then those would be different. You know, but that's one strategy that you could use to kind of fudge if you didn't get the numbers that you wanted to, you know, from the first attempt.
Absolutely. There's two phases to this. There's the recipe design and the planning, and what you think you'll get to be able to blend to get your outcomes. Then we draw a line under that bit. Then you go and do it, and you take measurements as you go, most important. Then you end up with copper one and copper two being different gravities and different volumes. So you replug that into the spreadsheet, and then you start adjusting. So you've got a planning phase to get you in the ballpark, and then you've got a practical application of what did you get. And if your gravity sample of copper two is not right, then yeah, obviously you could boil a bit more, you could add a bit more extract, or you could live with it, because you could just fiddle with the blends to suit.
Mm.
So yeah, it is quite a flexible system.
Our friends and sponsors at Groenfell and Havoc Meaderies now have exciting mead starter packs. Not familiar with delicious craft meads? Check out the Classic Mead Sampler at Groenfell.com. It's got a 4-pack each of Groenfell's Valkyrie's Choice, Old Wayfarer, and Nordic Farmhouse. Or, if you're a bit more adventurous, go with the Modern Mead Sampler with a 4-pack each of 3 Havoc Meads, Psychopomp, Root of All Evil, and Hop Swarm. Now, Root of All Evil, that's got some ginger in it, and is delicious. And Hop Swarm, of course, is dry hopped. Each starter pack comes with a free mead guide and a cocktail recipe card, and free shipping across the country. And you'll also find some fun mystery swag tossed in there, too. Ricky and Kelly want you to step into the delicious world of craft mead. like so many other certified Mediacs who are already on board. Check out all the tasty honey-based deliciousness at Groenfell.com. That's Groenfell. Now, you mentioned brewing sugars, and you sent me a photograph that you had gotten a bottle of dark Cairo syrup, but I never heard if you used it or not. Did you do anything with it?
Yes, I did. I made a mild with it. It's very fermentable, not at all like my experience with making, say, invert number three. And the darkness didn't seem to translate into the final beer color. Overall, I was a bit disappointed. I've still got half a bottle left. So I think you call them pecans, but I call them pecans. It might end up in a beer yet, but plan B might be the dessert.
The pecan pie recipe on the bottle is excellent. So yeah, you can't lose with that for sure.
Yeah, it lacked for me the with a good quality invert using the molasses. And the molasses with the licorice that it imparts. I like that licorice tang in the background, and obviously the Cairo syrup didn't have that. But I did give it a crack, and it gives me an idea what you were tasting on the
on the sampler show.
Attempt at my recipe. Yes.
Oh, well, we did that.
I wasn't going to bring that up. You started.
Well, on a recent episode that you may not have gotten to yet, we did a sugar sampler where we compared dark molasses with dark Cairo syrup and Hungry Jack pancake syrup. And guess which one we like the best?
The one with the molasses.
No, we like the pancake syrup the best. I can't see you, but I can hear your eyes rolling as you.
They were spinning, spinning pancake syrup.
And you know what I did today? My wife and I bottled a 5-gallon batch of a Belgianish, what I'm calling a double, a Hungry Jack pancake syrup double. And you know what? It tasted pretty good going in the bottle. So.
Does it taste of pancakes, though?
No, it doesn't taste buttery. Thank goodness. There's a little bit of a maple flavor in there, but it's just kind of a. We found that it, and maybe because they put all the artificial flavors in there, but it was more complex of flavor than the certainly than the Cairo syrup. But I know that Vermonters are going to get really mad at me for not using just maple. Maple syrup from the tree, but we made a delicious beer with maple syrup. You know, we've done that before, so we decided to do
well
this
and let alone the Canadians.
Oh yeah, yeah. But yeah. They they won't be outwardly angry with me. They'll just be they're too nice.
Quietly.
That's right. They'll say something. They'll say something that they think is offensive toward me, and I won't even recognize it as an insult. So,
I think the Cairo syrup would go in if you wanted to do a Schwarzbier or something like that, where it would give some color and just dry it out. If you're in a low gravity mild, it just was too insipid. You want something with a bit of character when you've got such a low gravity of 10.35, I think it was.
Oh, wow. Yeah, sure. Well, there you go. You know, now we know. but do make the pie though, because it only takes, just a short amount of time to make a delicious pie.
Right.
And it's super easy to do.
I'll have to put it on my list. This whole lockdown thing has been going on for so long now. My sourdough skills are up several notches. My cakes are not too bad. I made clotted cream the other week. Suppose I could do a dessert. My crumble's not bad. Lots of practice.
I hear an ointment, you know. I can recommend an ointment that's good for the crumbles.
Good.
Well, Peter, any last words? Any last words of nuggets of wisdom when designing these party guiles and other than get your book Guile Brews and go to Triton Books on YouTube to watch your videos.
Well, they're all good things to do, but the most important thing to me is to put aside that party guile is complicated. It is more involved, but you need to just do it. It's a bit like triple decoction, if you like, where triple decoction is something that I've never done. Because I don't brew very many lagers, I'm not sure I really need to. It's one of those things that if you haven't party guiled, treat it as a bit of a challenge as to how you can use your system, whatever system that is, to be able to produce two quite different beers from the one mash. So treat it as a challenge.
And bring a friend.
I think a friend would be good, especially if they had a portable one-vessel system, would probably make things quite quite manageable.
Yeah, bring a friend who has a brew pot.
yeah.
Well, excellent.
And no drinking during the brew day, of course.
Yeah, of course not. Be responsible and take notes just in case you do accidentally drink a beer or two and don't remember what went into your recipe. That's never happened.
Of course not.
Oh, well, Peter, it's always a pleasure to get together with you. I'm always happy to talk to you about brewing stuff. You always inspire me to try different things. Sometimes I follow through, sometimes I don't, but but it's always a pleasure to get together, and I wish you a end of the lockdown soon.
Why, thank you. I think we're all looking forward to whatever the inverted commas new normal is. So, yeah. But thanks for having me on. It's been great. Hopefully it's inspired a couple of people to give party guiling a bit of a crack.
Excellent. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, James.
Well, thanks again to Peter for walking us through that. It's a lot less I'm a lot less confused now. And after our conversation, Peter sent me a picture of two full no-chill cubes ready for blending. So he's back at it. Now, to find Peter's book, Guile Brews, Google Peter Simons, that's Peter, and then S-Y-M-O-N-S, Guile Brews, G-U-I-L-E, Brews. And that'll take you to the lulu.com page, where you can order it. And look for the video that we talked about on YouTube by searching for Triton Books, T-R-I-T-U-N Books. A lot of spelling in this episode. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check all that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well, stay tuned. So long.